The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Alec Kerr. I'm a former chair of the Board of Trustees of the Free Library, and it's my sincere pleasure to welcome you here tonight and to introduce our speaker, Calvin Trillin. I am very impressed that we have a full room that might speak a little bit about our priorities in terms of State of the Union, but I think it... But I think it'll give Mr. Trillin a lot of comfort in terms of his audience. Before we get started, please take a moment to turn off your cell phones. That's critical to the success of any of these events, and it just makes a great difference. Mr. Trillin will be signing books in the lobby after his remarks, and I hope you'll join us upstairs. I've had the privilege of knowing Mr. Trillin for many years. My father happened to be his publisher. I have to say, two books have really moved me more than any others in terms of their portrayal of human courage. One was by my godfather, Stuart Alsop, about his battle with cancer. The other is Bud Trillin's About Alice, which is the book we are here to share tonight. She was an extraordinary example to all of us of true grace, of courage, of how to live, and how to die. And what's really remarkable about this book is its poignancy and power, not as a tale of courage, but as a love story. For that's what this book really is. At least to me, no Shakespeare sonnet and no ode by Keats has ever moved me more. If you read the body of Bud Trillin's work, you think you know how he felt about Alice, and to an extent, you think you actually know her. You certainly know her views on food. Three meals a day was enough. You know her views on school plays. If you didn't go to every performance of your child's play, including the special Thursday afternoon matinee, the county would come and take the child. You knew Alice was Bud's best muse and his straight man. They were once introduced as a literary George Burns and Gracie Allen. Obviously, Bud was Gracie, and Alice was George. You know Alice was a knockout. She was a wonderful author. There, see? Let's work on that cell phone. She was an educator. She was a producer of home movies. She was TM, the mom. But in About Alice, you will gain new insights into the overwhelming depth and breadth of their love, yet with a light touch. You can understand why wives now ask, even those who don't know the Trillins, will he love me the way Calvin Trillin loved Alice? Bud acknowledges that everything he wrote for Alice. And he maintains, when responding to an old friend's question about how did you manage to get Alice and keep her, he says, dumb luck. Not true. They were uniquely suited for each other, and it was their mutual love and support that enabled her to fight the battle for so long and so successfully. 25 years battling cancer is a long time. She lived to see her daughters married. She never stopped battling the dragon, even when its eye was fixed right in her. One of the Trillin's daughters said at the funeral, in referring to her mother, "She was the coolest girl I ever knew." You will agree, after you read this book, I know Alice would have loved it, and she might even have given it one of her ultimate compliments, wowzers. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Calvin Trillin.
Thank Thank you, Alec, for that kind introduction. I always say to people who are going to introduce me, and they say, I don't know what to say. I said, don't be worried about being too effusive. And I'm not going to impugn the motives or the patriotism. I'm not going to impugn the patriotism of people who skip the State of the Union address to be here. And if you think about how our enemies are going to react to that, that's on your own conscience. Once I was supposed to speak at the Syracuse Library, and as I was driving in from the airport, the library person who picked me up said he was terribly worried because O.J. Simpson had was scheduled to give his first interview that night to NBC. And I said, well, we're not worried about that competition. And apparently O.J. heard that I was speaking at the Syracuse Library, and he called it off at the last minute. I don't think George Bush will do that, but what I've been doing is reading some of the pieces that involve Alice from the period when I wrote about her as what I call in the book a sort of sitcom mom. As Alex said, she was the sensible person in the family. And was sort of cast in the lighter pieces I wrote about family or travel or eating as the person who kept the family on even keel despite the antics of her marginally goofy husband. And it wasn't incorrect, exactly. She was definitely the most sensible grown-up in the house, but it wasn't a full portrait. And about Alice is an attempt to sort of correct the record. So I'm going to read a few pieces in her sitcom role, and then I'll read the first part of about Alice. This is from Alice Let's Eat, the beginning of Alice Let's Eat, which is a book I published in 1978 and has just been reissued with this book. Now that it's fashionable to reveal intimate details of married life, I can state publicly that my wife, Alice, has a weird predilection for limiting our family to three meals a day. I also might as well admit that the most serious threat to our marriage came in 1975, when Alice mentioned my weight just as I was about to sit down to dinner at a New Orleans restaurant named Chez Helene. I hardly need add that Chez Helene is one of my favorite restaurants in New Orleans. We do not have the sort of marriage that could come to grief over ordinary food. Without wanting to be legalistic, I should mention that Alice brought up the weight issue during a long-distance telephone call, breaking whatever federal regulations there are against interstate appetite impairment. Like many people who travel a lot on business, I'm in the habit of calling home every evening to share the little victories and defeats of the day. The triumph, for instance, of happening upon a superior tamale stand in a town I thought had long before been completely carved into spheres of influence by McDonald's and Burger King. Or the misery of being escorted by some local booster past the unmistakable aroma of genuine hickory wood barbecuing into La Maison de la Casa House. Continental cuisine, whose notion of continental cuisine seems to have been derived in some arcane way from the Continental Trailways Bus Company. Having found myself on business in New Orleans, or as it is sometimes expressed around my office, having found it my business to find business in New Orleans, I was about to settle into Chez Helene for a long evening. First, of course, I telephoned Alice in New York. I assumed it would give her great pleasure to to hear that her husband was about to have enough sweet potatoes and fried oysters to make him as happy as he could manage to be outside her presence. Scholars of the art have often mentioned Chez Helene as an example of what happens when Creole blends with soul, so that a bowl of greens comes out tasting of spices that the average greens maker in Georgia or Alabama probably associates with papists or the devil himself. "I'm about to have dinner at Chez Helene," I said. "Dr. Sullivan just told me that you weighed 180 pounds when you were in his office last week," Alice said. "That's terrible." "There must be something wrong with this connection," I said. "I could swear I just told you that I was about to have dinner at Chez Helene." "You're going to have to go on a diet," she said. "This is serious." It occurred to me that a man telephoning his wife from a soul food restaurant could, on the excuse of trying to provide some authentic atmosphere, say something like, "Watch your mouth, woman." Instead, I said, "I think there might be a better time to talk about this, Alice." Toward the end of the second or third term of the Caroline Kennedy administration was the sort of time I had in mind. "Well, we can talk about it when you get home," Alice said. "Have a nice dinner." I did. It is a measure of my devotion, Alice, that I forgave her, even though my second order of fried chicken was ruined by the realization that I had forgotten to tell her I had actually weighed only 166 pounds. I always allow 14 pounds for clothes. This is a column I wrote in about 1985. "My wife keeps telling me that I don't really hate the neighbor of ours who talks a lot about the importance of trim and gutter maintenance. I've had this problem with my wife before. She is the person who insisted that I was only joking when I said several years ago that people who sell macrame ought to be dyed a natural color and hung out to dry. It was my wife who argued that I had no legal standing for making a citizen's arrest of someone for performing mime in public. It's clearer than ever that she is to blame for the children's excessive tolerance. I haven't done any trim and gutter maintenance in so long that I'm no longer quite certain what there is about them that needs to be maintained. I also feel that way about the points and plugs on the car. I know they're important, but I can't quite remember just why. The same neighbor, he can be called Elwood here, although around the house I always refer to him as Old Glittering Gutters, cannot see my car without patting it on the hood as if it were an exceedingly large Airedale and saying, 'When was the last time you had a good look at the points and plugs?' I'd rather not say, I always reply. It's none of his business. His points and plugs are, I'm sure, sharply pointed and firmly plugged in, or whatever they're supposed to be. His trim and gutters are, it goes without saying, carefully maintained. You could probably eat out of Elwood's gutters if that's the kind of person you were. I hate him." "You don't really hate him," my wife said. "You may think he's a little too well organized for your tastes, and you may not want him over for dinner all the time, but you don't hate him." "Wrong." "Elwood has a list of what's in his basement." "He says that the list is invaluable. He wonders why I don't have a list of what's in my basement. He doesn't seem to understand that if I made such a list, it would have to be a list of what might be in my basement, and it would have to include the possibility of crocodiles. Elwood's list is cross-indexed. A man who has a cross-index list of what's in his basement is not a little too well organized. He's hateful. The other day, Elwood asked me what sort of system I use to label my circuit breakers. I tried to remain calm. I tried to think of reasons why Elwood would assume that someone who had already confessed ignorance as to the whereabouts of his 1984 gasoline credit card receipts would have his circuit breakers labeled at all, let alone have them labeled according to some system. I calculated as precisely as I could what chance there was that a jury, learning of the question that preceded the crime, would bring in a verdict of not guilty on the grounds that the strangling of Elwood had clearly been a crime of passion. The system I'm using now, I finally said, is to label them sleepy, grumpy, sneezy, happy, dopey, doc, and bashful. However, I've given a lot of thought to switching to a system under which I would label them Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, Vixen, Comet, Cupid, Donder, and Bruce. I'm holding up my final decision until a friend of mine who has access to a large computer runs some probability studies. Probability of what? Elwood said. I noticed that as he asked the question, he retreated a step or two toward his own house. Just probability, I said. When I got back inside my house, I told my wife about the conversation. Poor man, she said. He probably thinks you're dangerous. He may be right, I said. You have to try to think of Elwood as a human being, my wife said. Someone with feelings and a wife and children who love him. I suspect his children perform mime or sell macrame in public, I said. Also, she said, it really wouldn't be such a bad idea to label the circuit breakers. I looked at her for a while. You're right, of course, I finally said. I got a felt tip pen, went to the circuit breaker box, and started right in. Sleepy, grumpy, sneezy. This is a poem that was in the New Yorker in November of 1994. This is the first poem I ever published in the New Yorker. I thought that publishing a poem in the New Yorker was a sign that you were a serious poet. This triumph was slightly undercut by the fact that this poem was in the fashion issue of the New Yorker. The New Yorker, as you may know, is the highest paying magazine for poems. They pay $10 a line. You do the math, you understand why there's not a large crowd in front of the poetry booth at the Career Day Fair. This is called Just How Do You Suppose That Alice Knows? Just how do you suppose that Alice knows so much about what's au courant in clothes? You wouldn't really think that she's the sort to know much more than whether skirts are short or long again or somewhere in between. She's surely not the sort who would be seen in front row seats at Paris fashion shows. In fact, she looks at that sort down her nose. For her to read a fashion mag would seem as out of sync as reading Field and Stream. Biographies are what she reads instead, and yet she has in detail in her head whose indigos are drawing oohs and ohs. Just how do you suppose that Alice knows? We're leaving, and I'll ask her once we've gone, what was that thing that what's-her-name had on? It lacked a back. The front was sort of lined with gauzy stuff. It seemed to be the kind of frock that might be worn by Uncle Meyer if he played Blanche in Streetcar Named Desire. And Alice knows. She knows just who designed the rag and why some folks are of a mind to buy this Schmottemeister's frilly things for what a small brancusi usually brings. She mentions something newly chic this year. To me, it looked like antique fishing gear. I'm stunned, as if she talked in Urdu prose. Just how do you suppose that Alice knows? She gets no email info on design. She's au courant, but so far not online. No fashion maven tells her what is kitsch. She goes to no symposium at which she learns why some designers' models pose as Navajos or folks from UFOs. I know that women have no special gene providing knowledge of the fashion scene, the way that men all have, without a doubt, the chromosome for garbage taking out. And yet she's fashion conscious to her toes. Does she divine these things? Does she osmose what's in the air concerning hoes and bows? Just how do you suppose that Alice knows? This is a piece written in 1981 called Dinner at the De Laurentiis, which was written after a cover story in the New York Times Sunday Magazine said that the De Laurentiis had the a latter-day salon that for Le Nouveau Grand Monde, that was the new scene for new society. Another week has passed without my being invited to the De Laurentiis. Even that overstates my standing. Until I'd read in the New York Times Magazine about Françoise and Oscar de la Renta having become barometers of what constitutes fashionable society by creating what the Times called a latter-day salon for Le Nouveau Grand Monde, the very rich, very powerful, and very gifted, I hadn't even been aware of what I wasn't being invited to week after week. Once I knew, of course, it hurt. Every time the phone rang, I thought it might be Mrs. De La Renta with an invitation. Mr. Trillin, Francois De La Renta here. We're having a few very rich, very powerful, and or very gifted people over Sunday evening to celebrate Tisha B'Av. And we thought you and the missus might like to join us. The phone rang. It was the lady from the diner's club informing me how quickly a person's credit rating can deteriorate. The phone rang. It was my mother calling from Kansas City to ask if I'm sure I sent a thank you note to my cousin Edna for the place setting of stainless Edna and six other cousins went in on for our wedding gift in 1965. The phone rang. An invitation. Fats Goldberg, the pizza baron, asked if we'd like to bring the kids to his uptown branch Sunday night to sample the sort of pizza he regularly describes as a gourmet tap dance. Thanks, fat person, but I'll have to phone you, I said. We may have another engagement Sunday. The phone quit ringing. Why aren't I in Le Nouveau Grand Monde, I asked my wife, Alice. Because you speak French with a Kansas City accent, she asked in return. Not at all, I said. Sam Spiegel, the Hollywood producer, is a regular at the De Laurentiis, and I hear that the last time someone asked him to speak French, he said, Gucci. Why would you want to go there anyway, Alice said. Didn't you read that the host added his own de la to what had been plain old Oscar Renta? It's a true fact. Who can blame a man for not wanting to go through life sounding like a taxi driver, I said. Family background's not important in Le Nouveau Grand Monde. Diana Vreeland said Henry Kissinger is the star. The Vicomtesse de Rib says Francoise worships intelligence. You get invited by accomplishment. Taking over a perfume company, maybe, or invading Cambodia. Why don't we just call Fats and tell him we'll be there for a gourmet tap dance, Alice said. Maybe it would help if you started wearing dresses designed by Oscar de la Renta, I said. Some of his guests say they would feel disloyal downing Mrs. D's chicken fricassee while wearing someone else's merchandise. Alice shook her head. Oscar de la Renta designs those ruffly dresses that look like what the fat girl made a bad mistake wearing to the prom, she said. Things were a lot easier when fashionable society was limited to old rich goyim and all the rest of us didn't have to worry about being individually rejected, I said. At least they knew better than to mingle socially with their dressmakers, Alice said. Would I be ready if the De Laurentiis phone? Henry Kissinger, the star himself, said that the De Laurentiis set an interesting intellectual standard, although, come to think of it, that phrase could also be applied to Fats Goldberg. Alone at the kitchen table, I began to polish my dinner table chit-chat, looking first to the person I imagined being seated on my left, the Vicomtesse de Ribes, who finds it charming that her name reminds me of barbecue joints in Kansas City. And then to the person on my right, Barbara Walters, another regular, who has tried to put me at my ease by confessing that in French she doesn't do her R's terribly well. Listen, Alice said, I read in the Times that Mrs. De Laurentiis is very strict about having only one of each sort of person at a dinner party. Maybe they already have someone from Kansas City. Possible. Jerzy Kosinski mentioned that Mrs. D is so careful about not including more than one stunning achiever from each walk of life that he and Norman Mailer have never been at the De Laurentiis on the same evening. She understands that every profession generates a few princes or kings, Kosinski says. When I arrive, I like to think that as a novelist, I'm unique. Then I realized that the one of each rule could work to my advantage. As I envision it, Henry Kissinger phones Mrs. D only an hour before dinner guests are to arrive. He had been scheduled to pick up 15 grand that night for explaining Salt II to the Vinyl Manufacturers Association convention in Chicago, but the airports are snowed in. You can see how old this column is. I mean, Henry Kissinger wouldn't go down to the lobby of his building for 15 grand now, I don't think. Kissinger says he and Nancy will be able to come to dinner after all. How marvelous, darling, Mrs. D says. She hangs up and suddenly looks stricken. My God, she says to Oscar, what are we going to do? We already have one war criminal coming. What to do except to phone the man who conflicts with the star, tell him that the dinner had to be called off because Mr. D had come down with a painful skin disease known as the 7th Avenue Spilkies. What to do about the one male place at the table now empty between Vicomtesse de Ribes and Barbara Walters? The phone rings. This is Françoise de Laurenta, the voice says. This is Calvin of the Trillin, I say. I'll be right over. This is a column from 1988 called Costume Planning. Those who persist in thinking that I don't take enough interest in my wardrobe are apparently not aware of how much effort goes into the selection of my Halloween costume. Most years I begin preliminary planning in August. Do you think I've overdone my axe murderer's mask? I asked my wife this August as she sat on the dock late on a sunny afternoon reading a book. Don't be afraid to say so if that's the way you feel. I want you to be absolutely honest about this. My wife said, apparently thinking I had said something about how the wind seemed to be coming up a bit. I was asking about my axe murderer's mask for Halloween, I said. You think I've overdone it? You ask me that every August, my wife said, without looking up from her book. Well, it's always nice to have family traditions, I said. It's true that my Halloween costume planning often begins with a discussion of my axe murderer's mask. In our neighborhood, we have a big costume parade on Halloween, and after annual discussions about the advantage of adopting an entirely new look, I do often end up parading in my axe murderer's mask, I love my axe murderer's mask. But the mask itself is certainly not my entire costume. Every year I have to select what I suppose you might call the accessories. Did you think that old bathrobe was a good addition last year? I asked my wife. Last Halloween, I wore my axe murderer's mask, a baseball hat that had on the front the name South Brooklyn Casket Company, and a picture of a casket on it, an old bathrobe, and fastened to my forearm in an extremely realistic rubber lizard. I've been wearing the baseball hat for a couple of years now. It was a gift from my friend Fred, who moved from New York to Maryland where he didn't think he'd need it. And I've always worn the lizard, but the bathrobe was a new touch last year. I'd like to say, by the way, I don't wear the bathrobe anymore. Because a friend gave me a T-shirt from a bail bondsman in California, which has its name of the bail bondsman company and its number and its motto, which is, because your mama wants you home. Actually, a lot of people didn't quite understand that costume, my wife said. They asked me what exactly you were supposed to be. I was supposed to be an axe murderer who works in a casket factory and likes to walk around in an old bathrobe with a lizard on his arm, I said. And I thought I was rather convincing in that role. Also, it turned out that nobody else in the parade had thought of going in that particular costume. During the weeks before Halloween, people in our neighborhood kind of feel each other out about costumes. What are you going as, is the normal greeting on the street. But it's still possible to spend months working on your killer bee costume, then show up Halloween night to find that you're not the only killer bee in the crowd. You might spot someone who, with accompaniment from a built-in tape deck, is doing a pretty good imitation of a killer bee mambo up from South America. Someone else is there as a killer bee whose wings make your wings look kind of stumpy. Two or three people are doing killer bees as celebrities. What Bette Midler would look like as a killer bee, maybe. Or a killer bee as Kurt Waldheim. There are 25 people from an aerobics class costumed as a swarm of killer bees. You feel a little bit like going home and getting into the Donald Duck costume you wore the year before. I know how I'd feel if I showed up one year to find all sorts of people costumed as an axe murderer who works in a casket factory and likes to walk around in a bathrobe with a lizard on his arm. Actually, that's one of the possibilities I tend to discuss with my wife in August. You don't think I might have spawned a lot of imitators, do you? I asked her this summer. I think you can put your mind to rest on that score, she said. She was probably right. Still, there was a great temptation to take a completely fresh approach with my costume, to go to the parade as a butter churn, maybe, or as Woodrow Wilson. I know there would be risks in that. We all admired my friend Ernie's ambition when he decided to go as the March of the Toy Soldiers, for instance, but we all thought his costume simply demonstrated that the concept was too much for one person to carry off alone. I think I might stick with the axe murderer's mask and the same accessories, if that's the way you feel, I said to my wife. Of course, this is only preliminary. My wife said. And this is the first section of about Alice, which has its epigraph, the first line of the passage I read from Alice, Let's Eat, which is about limiting our family to three meals a day. There was one condolence letter that made me laugh. Naturally, a lot of them made me cry. Some of those, oddly enough, were from people who had never met Alice. They had become familiar with her as a character in books and magazine pieces I'd written, light books and magazine pieces about traveling or eating or family life. Virtually all those letters began in the same way, with a phrase like, even though I never really knew Alice. I was certain of what Alice's response would have been. They're right about that, she would have said. They never knew me. I once wrote that tales about writers' families tend to have a relation to real life that can be expressed in terms of standard network television fare on a spectrum that goes from sitcoms to Lifetime movies, and that mine were sitcoms. Now that I think of it, maybe they were more like the Saturday morning cartoons. Alice played the role of the mom, the voice of reason, the sensible person who kept everything on an even keel despite the antics of her marginally goofy husband. Years ago, at a conference of English teachers where we were both speakers, the professor who did the introduction said something like, "Alice and Bud are like Burns and Allen, except she's George and he's Gracie." Yes, of course, the role she played in my stories was based on the role she played in our family. Our daughters and I sometimes called her TM, which stood for the mother. But she didn't play it in the broad strokes of a sitcom mom. Also, she was never completely comfortable as the person who takes responsibility for keeping things on an even keel. That person inevitably misses out on some of the fun. "I feel the need to break out of the role of straight person," she said in a Nation review of Alice Let's Eat, that cautioned readers against abandoning long-planned European vacations in order to scour the country for the perfect roast polecat haunch. The sitcom presentation sometimes made her sound stern as well as wise, and she was anything but stern. She had something close to a child's sense of wonderment. She was the only adult I ever knew who might respond to encountering a deer on a forest path by saying, "Wowzers." Once during a question and answer period that followed a speech I had given at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco, someone asked how Alice felt about the way she was portrayed in my books and articles. I said that she thought the portrayal made her sound like what she called a dietitian in sensible shoes. Then the same questioner asked if Alice was in the audience. And when I said she was, he asked if she'd mind standing up. Alice stood. As usual, she looked smashing. She didn't say anything. She just leaned over and took off one of her shoes. Shoes that looked like they cost about the amount of money required in some places to tide a family of four over for a year or two. And smiling, waved it in the air. She wasn't a dietitian in sensible shoes, and she would have been right in saying that the people whose exposure to her had been through my stories didn't know her. Still, in the weeks after she died, I was touched by their letters. They may not have known her, but they knew how I felt about her. It surprised me that they had managed to divine that from reading stories that were essentially sitcoms. Even after I'd taken in most episodes of The Honeymooners, after all, it had never occurred to me to ponder the feelings Ralph Cramden must have had for Alice Cramden. Yet I got a lot of letters like the one from a young woman in New York who wrote that she sometimes looked at her boyfriend and thought, "But will he love me like Calvin loves Alice?" The letter that made me laugh was from Roger Wilkins. By the time of Alice's death, Roger occupied a chair of history and American culture at George Mason University. But in the 70s, he had been on the editorial board of the New York Times. In that period, I'd sometimes join the regular lunches he had with the late Richard Harris, a remarkable investigative reporter for the New Yorker who had the aggressively unsentimental worldview often found among people in his line of work. Alice and Roger became acquainted when she accompanied me to a conference I was covering in New Orleans. In off hours when we'd gather around the hotel swimming pool, she and Roger sometimes had long, serious conversations. It wasn't unusual for me to find Alice having long, serious conversations with people I'd been bantering with for years. She got engaged with people's lives. If she said to a friend's son or daughter, "How's school?" she wasn't just being polite. She wanted details, and she wasn't shy about offering advice. If people we were visiting mentioned that they'd been thinking about renovating their house, Alice was right on the case, room by room. In these architectural conversations, she could get bossy. And sometimes I felt obliged to warn our hosts that one of her characteristic gestures, the gesture she used when she was saying something like, "You have to open all of this up," was remarkably similar to the gesture you'd use to toss money into the wind. She wasn't among those whose response to tragedy or loss was limited to offering the conventional expressions of sympathy before moving on with their own lives. In 1988, an old friend phoned us to say that his grown daughter, a young woman we'd known since she was a child, had been raped by an intruder. This was a dozen years after Alice had been operated on for lung cancer, and among the things she wrote to our friend's daughter was that having lung cancer and being raped were comparable only in that both were what she called realizations of our worst nightmares. She said that there was some relief at surviving what you might have thought was not survivable. No one would ever choose to have cancer or to be raped, she wrote, but you don't get to choose. And it is possible at least to understand what Ernest Becker meant when he said something like, to live fully is to live with an awareness of the rumble of terror that underlies everything, or to begin to understand the line in King Lear, ripeness is all. You might have chosen to become ripe less dramatically or dangerously, but you can still savor ripeness. Alice had a large envelope in which she kept copies of letters like that, along with copies of some letters she had sent the girls, and copies of poems we had written for her birthdays, and documents like the announcement of a prize for community service that Abigail, our older daughter, had been awarded at Yale, and an astonishing letter of recommendation that a professor had provided for Sarah, our younger daughter, when she applied for her first job after getting her MSW. On the envelope was written, important stuff. In his condolence letter, Roger talked partly about that engaged quality in Alice, but he also got around to her appearance. She was nice, and she was concerned, and she was smart, and when she talked to you, she was thinking about you. And also, she was so very pretty, he wrote in September of 2001, a few days after Alice died. I always thought of you as a wonderful guy, but still I couldn't figure out how you managed to get Alice. Harris once told me it was just dumb luck. When I read that, I burst out laughing. Harris had nailed it again. Thank you.
Well, we have time for a few questions so that you will all have a chance to get your book signed upstairs. So we have a volunteer on each aisle, and we'd like you to raise your hand. We'll get the microphone to you very quickly. Please raise your hand.
No questions. There's one down there.
Oh, please wait. Look at the microphone there. Sorry, I didn't see you.
How did you meet Alice?
I met Alice at a party given by a doomed magazine of political satire called Monocle. The meeting is in the book. Monocle was on precarious financial grounds. But as it failed as a magazine, the parties got bigger and bigger. And I told the editor, Monocle, Victor Navasky, later became editor of The Nation, that Monocle was much more successful as a marriage brokerage than as a magazine, because a lot of people with some connection to Monocle or meeting each other at Monocle or something around that time got married, and we called them in our house Monocle marriages because they were all long-lasting marriages, and which is, I've said once that long-term marriage is now intertwined in the public mind with the music of Lawrence Welk. And someone asked me last week in an interview, how do you account for all the Monocle marriages being so long-lived? And I said, I hadn't thought about it, but the only way I could figure it out was that maybe that Monocle, which was this cutting-edge magazine of political satire that thought of itself as so hip, had somehow attracted the squarest people in New York. So we met at a Monocle party.
Okay. Another question, please raise your hand. Right in the middle.
What were the challenges for Alice of being married to somebody as funny as you?
Well, I guess hearing the same joke more than once. I think anybody who speaks in public and has a spouse in the audience recognizes what I call the not that old chestnut again sigh. She really didn't like some of the stories that I told. She hated the story about Chubby, my collie dog, which I may have even told here, but there's a true story about my problem in writing memoirs, since I didn't really have any hideous secret to reveal. I had... I think it's safe to say this in Philadelphia. I had a happy childhood. I'd appreciate you not spreading that around. And that I can picture myself in these... I went to a memoir conference in Florida, in what I call the January Dip in Airfares Literary Conference. They have at Key West every year, and I could picture myself with these guys in a memoirist hangout. They're each revealing their hideous secret, and they come to me and they have, you have a secret, and I say, looks like my little collie dog, Chubby, and they look at me with great disdain. But it's a true story, and I was three or four or five, I guess, and my sister and I, our family had a little collie puppy named Chubby, and he was quite sickly. And one day he disappeared, and we said to our parents, "Where's Chubby?" And they said, "Well, we took him to a farm that some friends of ours have, and there he'll have a lot of sunlight and be able to frolic with the other animals in the barnyard." And I didn't think much about it after that. And then Chubby's name came up some years later. I was home from college, and we were all having dinner. And I said, "Why don't we ever go visit Chubby at the farm?" And my sister said, "There wasn't any farm, you dummy. Chubby had to be put down." And I said, "Chubby's gone?" And and my mother said, "Chubby probably be gone in any case, because collies didn't usually live 18 or 20 years." And I said, "Yeah, but why am I just finding out now?" And my father said, "It's not our fault you're slow in the uptake." And so I guess I wrote about memoirs or something, and I included that. And about a week later, I got a call from my sister. And she said, "The collie was not called Chubby. The collie was called George." So you were called Chubby. I could hear the not that old chestnut again sigh just now when I told that. Didn't like that story. Alice grew up in the East, and so she knew about the kind of Eastern notion of humor as a defense and all that. I would sometimes do my parrot imitation when I heard that. Humor is a defense. Humor is a defense. So it was a trial, but she was good about it.
Yes, right here. How come our volunteers are always at the other end of the... No, we'll be right here.
I'm almost done with Art Buchwald's book, and I was just curious. You're mentioned in it a bunch, and how was that? It just sounds like he really had a good time at the end there.
Art Buchwald, I told Art Buchwald, he's the only person I know who walked out of the hospice in the front door. as most of you probably know, Art Buchwald was given a sentence of kidney dialysis, and he'd already lost a leg, and he decided he just didn't want to do it, and he went to a hospice, and nothing happened. I told him, I've seen him a couple times, I saw him at a kind of book party for this book in New York, and again at the funeral for Johnny Apple, R.W. Apple, and I said, wouldn't it be funny if a humor columnist discovered that you actually don't need kidneys? I mean, after all of these guys with degrees work on this for years and years and years. So he was funny till the day he died. He was a wonderful, generous-hearted, decent man.
Okay, we have another question up front.
Mr. Trellin, I started reading the New Yorker magazine around the same time you started writing for it, and I always went to the table of contents first to see if there was something by you, so I'm a really big fan. Now, my question is, were the Shopsons happy or unhappy that you wrote about their little restaurant?
Oh, this is a restaurant that I wrote about, a rather eccentric restaurant near my house in New York. Well, I had his permission to write about it to start that time. The other time, he cooperated when I wrote about it when it was a corner store, and then they sort of turned the corner store gradually into a restaurant. And it was about a 25 or 30 seat restaurant, and he had 900 items on the menu. And the fact checkers in the New Yorker actually counted them twice. And there were 900. I thought there were about 600, but they counted them. There were 900. And in the 20 years or so that my family went there all the time, we never found him out of anything. And they all tasted different too. They weren't just sort of standard things. I mean, and he was eccentric about his rules. For instance, if you were sitting there, and there was always sort of a general conversation among the diners as well as your own conversation, and you saw someone next to you eating something that looked great, and you'd say, "What is that?" And the person would say, "It's Burmese hummus," which I hardly need tell you was neither Burmese nor hummus. And then the waitress came and said, and you said, "I'd like some Burmese hummus." No copying. You weren't. You want to come tomorrow and have some Burmese hummus? Fine, but not now. I think he was pleased that I wrote about it. He complained, of course, I felt that was sort of normal. He complained that I can't remember what he complained about, but I think he was pleased.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's all thank very much Calvin Trellin.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.